Jason's going to talk about the movements of the 60s and how we can really draw lessons from that that we can apply to today. So,
The title of this talk is the Power of Protest, right? And if you really wanted to speak on the power of protest, you'd have to ask Slobin Milosevic to speak. It's only a week ago that he was stealing elections in Serbia, but he came up against the power of protest. Huge mass demonstrations, a general strike, he sent the police to break it, the coal miners fought back, the police cracked, the troops started to go over, everyone knew he wouldn't be defended. Hundreds of thousands of people poured into Belgrade for a mass uprising that overthrew the government. Now that's protest. Okay? And what its potential is. Tuesday night, I was at something, a protest meeting that was not as dramatic, but I'm also extremely excited about it. It was the rally for Nader in Chicago. 10,000 people turned out to protest corporate control of the United States and call for a protest vote for Nader. 2 years ago, you could not have gotten those 10,000. Oh, and Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam sang. He sang Dylan's song, "The Times They Are A-Changin'." And he was absolutely right. 2 years ago, you couldn't have gotten those people into that room because they weren't, that's not where they were at. And they were cheering. You know, when Seattle was mentioned, standing ovation. Any left-wing idea, yay! That is, they were moving. There were people, most of them had never been to a meeting before in their lives. Okay? For the first, there's a new wind blowing here and internationally. For the first time in 25 years, since the corporations have had their own way internationally, there is protest against it. And it's on a million different questions. You can just see the mood about it. It is, in many respects, it's the mood like the early 1960s. Here, if you pick up this week's Socialist Worker, you will see nothing but protests of all kinds and all sizes, shapes, and forms about Nader being excluded from the debate in Boston and in Providence and in Winston-Salem and in Atlanta, death penalty in Texas, the IMF and the World Bank throughout the country, sweatshops in New York, Palestinians, LA is a strike city. There's a new mood of protest that is developing in this country, and I want to look at the 60s from not from a nostalgia trip, but from the vantage point of what lessons we can learn. You know, the great Russian revolutionary Lenin said the 1917 revolution was successful because there was a defeated 1905 revolution that we learned the lessons from it. He said it was a dress rehearsal for success. That's the way I hope to look at the 60s today. It was a great movement, but it was defeated. We can learn the lessons. It can be a dress rehearsal for a new period of protest that this time we hope can be successful. Now, the 60s was the last period of protest, of struggle based upon two mass movements, black liberation and the anti-war movement. By 1970, millions of people in this country considered themselves to be revolutionaries. 20% of college students said they were either for or sympathetic to the idea of the formation of a mass revolutionary party in this country as the way in which to get social change. 40% of young blacks under 25 identified with the Black Panther Party. You had student strikes sweeping through the universities, 200 black ghetto uprisings, working class troops in the United States Army, mutinied, destroyed the army, and it collapsed. We are told that things like that can't happen in America. Oh, in Yugoslavia and Indonesia, but not here. For 25 years, they have tried to push this, sweep it under the rug, convince you that it can't happen so that you don't get an attitude. You don't become confident enough to fight back. The first lesson of the 60s is there is huge potential mass support for radical and revolutionary ideas from ordinary working class people who may appear apathetic or cynical or even conservative on the surface, but who are oppressed and exploited. And if a credible alternative can be built that fights against their oppression and exploitation, they move to radical and revolutionary positions. Okay? It takes years, however, for that to develop. The 60s ended with mass radical struggle. That's not the way it began. It began with small struggles, smaller than what is going on today in a more conservative country. In 1960, we still had the Cold War, McCarthyism, and segregation. February 1st, 1960 was the turning point. Only none of us knew it at the time. It's only in hindsight that we knew that it was a turning point. Four black students walked into Woolworths in North Carolina and demanded to be served a cup of coffee. And within months, a few thousand black students in the South were engaged in sit-ins. A few thousand black and white students in the North were holding support picket lines at Woolworths. It was the start of movement, but it took 3 or 4 years of almost constant struggle for that movement to develop a critical mass, to develop a credible alternative, and for the people who were in it to develop the political ideas that could lead the movement in a radical direction. Because the people who started it were not radicals. They had a confused set of ideas, half liberal, half radical. It's how all movements begin. There's no such thing as revolutionary immaculate conception. People do not start as revolutionary socialists. They begin like the NADA supporters. They're not. This was a crowd that wasn't a left crowd even. They're people who are moving. They're moving to the left from liberalism. Now, the important thing was that people wanted change and they were prepared to act on it. And that's the key thing. They were prepared to act, to do something, to change things. And two things happened. One, they learned that they had to rely upon themselves. They could not expect that change was going to come from above, that the people in charge were really going to change things, that if you elect Al Gore, he'll appoint 3 Joe Liebermans to the Supreme Court, and that will, you know, make sure that the wonderful criminal justice system that we have in this country doesn't turn it into a nightmare, where Bush will wind up with 2 million people in jail. They broke with those illusions about reform from above and decided to rely upon themselves and their own struggle. And the second thing is that in that struggle, they were changed. Their ideas changed. Their experience changed them. Let me just give you 2 quick ones. One's on nonviolence and the other Democratic Party. The movement started off on nonviolence. It's wonderful. Who wants to be for violence, right? People found out that the people who run this country, their police, their courts, the press, their are not pacifists. And that they were brutalizing and murdering civil rights workers. And you had a choice. What was more important, process or content? Did you want to win? Would you subordinate things to nonviolence? Or would you overcome it in order to win? And the movement overcame it. Its own experience convinced them that nonviolence does not work and that you had to use whatever means necessary to defend yourself in order to win. Secondly, there was the question of the Democratic Party. The break to radicalism took 4 years precisely because of the Democratic Party. It presented itself as the friend of the movement, the more human face of capitalism, the nicer people, the people who will help you and all sorts. The movement had to go through its own experiences to break with the Democratic Party. There were really 3 that did it. One was in 1964 when the Democratic Party refused to seat the integrated civil rights delegation from Mississippi and instead seated a segregated, all-white segregation delegation because Johnson wanted to carry the South. And all of the liberals who had supported the civil rights movement said, you have to go along with that. You have to go along with it because the Democratic Party's winning is more important than your struggle. It's like all the sort of Barney Franks and Patricia Irelands and who have come out against NATO, who, you know, deplored what was going on about, but once someone moved against the Democrats, they become the shock troops against any left-wing development. Secondly, you had the black ghetto uprisings in this country, and they were all in the northern cities, and they were all put down by not George Bush and the fascists, but by liberal Democratic Party mayors in every city. The troops were sent in by the liberal Democrats. And the war in Vietnam was not run by some, you know, Jesse Helms type. It was by John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. It was a liberal war. And so people started to break with the Democratic Party and liberalism. But it produced a sort of contradictory thing. Because the first break occurred among blacks, breaking with white liberalism and for black power. Now, that was great. They were breaking with white liberalism. They were for power. Black people in this country should have power. It introduced two problems, however. What's wrong with white liberalism? That it's white or that it's liberalism? Is black liberalism really much better? Well, what we learned with all the black mayors and police officials and congressmen and local officials and Colin Powell and Clarence Thomas is black liberalism is no better than white liberalism in truth. And not much. And secondly, that while black people should have power, where does power lie? And how do you actually get it? Whoops. Okay. Oh, I'm not doing so bad, I think. Maybe not. Okay. The cultural nationalist said what you should do is fight for community control of the schools and the police and so on. But the truth of the matter is power does not lie in the communities, particularly in the ghetto communities. It lies in what Al Gore calls controlling legal authorities. That is, in the corporations, the banks, Wall Street, the Pentagon, the State Department, and so on. Blacks should have power. They should get power. But they can only do so as a part of the United Working Class Movement. You're not going to have black power over Microsoft and woman power over IBM and gay power over AT&T and Chicano power over Citicorp. Or either there's a united struggle to take power on the part of the masses of working people in this country, or you can't, and that's one of the main lessons of the 60s, that those sorts of separate struggles do not come up against the question of power relationships of the Slobodan Milosevic's who run this country and who run its corporation and who have to be overthrown. Now, there was a leap to revolution in 1968. That is, the movement moved radical in 64, 65, and it moved to revolution and to revolutionary ideas. It took 8 years of struggle for that movement that started off in the early 60s as pacifist, nonviolent, liberal, to become revolutionary. I hope it won't take as long this time, but you should have a certain amount of patience. You should know that as people are going through struggles, they learn things and they get changed. It took 8 years and various international events. Because the United States is not an island. What led to it was, essentially, I'm not going to go into it, but there was the Tet Offensive at the beginning of 1968 when it was clear the United States had lost the war in Vietnam and the world policemen could not intervene everywhere, and there was an uprising virtually throughout the world. In Paris, in Rome, in Berlin, in Mexico, in India, Argentina, and so on. And the key event, particularly for the American left, was in Paris, where student demonstrations led to barricade fighting with the police. The trade unions called a strike in support of the students. It led to a general strike and to factory occupations spontaneously throughout the country. And when the main factory in Paris, the Renault Boulanger-Billancourt factory, was occupied, the workers put up a sign over it for higher wages and better pensions. But after a day of occupation, they took that down and they put up another banner over the factory. It said, for a socialist party, communist party, trade union government. And the third day, they took that down and they put up a sign over it. It said, for workers' control of production. In 3 days' time, consciousness had changed so dramatically in the French working class, and it led to what a period of international class struggle for the next 7 years, whose high points were the revolutions in Chile and Portugal, whose defeats were what set the left back internationally and so on. In this country, Paris was key in May, June in Paris was key in terms of its impact on the American left, but it threw it totally into confusion. Because until then, ideological chaos existed. Because until then, the American left was hostile to the idea of the working class and hostile to the idea of revolutionary organization. They believed that workers got the gains of imperialism, of racism, of sexism, that workers were part of the problem, that workers were the enemy, if anything, and that we needed new agents of social change from the third world, or students, or poor people, or on the part of the Black Panther Party, lumpen. They ignored working class struggle, even though strike levels were 10 times what they are today. Black workers were the people who took part in the ghetto uprisings. The majority of the people arrested in the Detroit uprising were members of the UAW, and the army was exploding because of the working class troops there. They just had totally ignored it, and they had no conception or sympathy with working class life or any idea of how to reach it. And secondly, they had opposed revolutionary organization. Until then, the idea, middle class ideas, had dominated the left. And those ideas are, we have a movement. What do we need a revolutionary party for? That would be divisive or sectarian. It would be, we shouldn't take any hard political positions. It will only antagonize some people. So let's leave politics on the lowest common denominator, which meant that there was very little political development of the movement or advance. And middle class individualism dominated things. People were hostile to organization, to leadership, to democratic decision-making. They were for consensus. However ineffective that would be, they were against any sort of discipline because what they were for was individual identity. That democratic decisions and everyone acting collectively together, that would interfere with their lifestyles and future careers. That was more important than building an effective movement. So there was no real idea of revolutionary organization. But 68, when it moved to revolution, poured huge numbers of people into the existing radical groups, the most important of them. The Black Panther Party, which in 1966 had 35 members, and in 1969 had 20,000 members. The Students for a Democratic Society, which in 1960 had 100 members, in 1966 had 3,000, and in 1969 had 100,000 members. But both of these organizations cracked up within a year. They had no routines, no program, no theory, no strategy, no tactics, no cadres. They did not know how to train or educate new people. They didn't know how to lead. They didn't know how to connect up with other people to act as a revolutionary in a mass movement and to lead it forward or anything like that. They had no sense of how to act, and they had no sense of a prolonged or protracted struggle. It was either immediate success or you give up, and they cracked up as they could not withstand the pressure of the American state, which came through with a carrot and stick, with both repression and concessions to buy some people off. They had no time in which to learn how to overcome those things. I can't really go into it because my time is almost up and I'm going to end on time. I don't believe it myself. I think just to sum up, one of the things that you have to understand is you need a certain patience as this historical process works it out, but you also need a certain urgency because radicalizations do not last forever. You either win or you lose. If you do not win, if they had not overthrown Slobodan Milosevic, what do you think things would be like in Yugoslavia now? All those people would be in jail. Okay? We won many, many things, you know, from abortion to gay rights, the end of segregation to the end of the war. We won tremendous gains, but power remains in their hands, and they spent the next 20 years chipping away, destroying, and so on and so forth. You either win or lose. And when I started off, I said, you want to learn
the lessons of defeat
so that you don't repeat the same mistakes. Don't make the mistakes our movement did. Make your own mistakes. Learn from them, but you should not have to spend 8 years to learn. You need to rely upon yourself. You need a mass movement from below. You can't trust the Democratic Party. You need unified struggles. It is only the working class that can do it, and you need a revolutionary political party. Those were the lessons of the 60s that people who went through those things came to by the end of the 60s, though they didn't just give up. But it took years to learn that. That's what we should be starting from and going beyond that. We're going to have to argue those same questions all over again, but people should know we want to draw the lessons to do so. What was wrong with the 60s, why they failed, was not, as they sometimes teach you, that it was too radical. It's because it was not radical enough, because people did not take power. The left in the last year or so in this country has started to grow again, and at a much faster pace than anyone could have thought, faster even in the early 60s, but it is even more unorganized and amorphous than the early 60s. There's tremendous energy and optimism and enthusiasm out there, but what it needs is revolutionary vision, revolutionary politics, and revolutionary organization. And so you should join the ISO and help build that. Help build a revolutionary working class party in this country that can lead all of the oppressed in an assault on American corporate capitalism by what is absolutely necessary, a change in power, economic, political, and social, from the people who own and run this country, the corporations, corporate capitalism, what do you want to call it, the ruling class of this country, to the people, to the ordinary people of this country, who have to take it back, who have to run it in their own interest, who have to use its resources to liberate themselves, to create a world in which work is creative and wonderful instead of miserable, in which people are liberated, in which there's freedom and democracy, that is socialism. So if you agree with that, join the ISO.